Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, has become a huge flashpoint in this year's presidential campaign. Donald Trump called it a rape of the country. Bernie Sanders said it threatens our democracy. Hillary Clinton once called it the gold standard in trade agreements. Now she's against it. President Obama is out this week pushing hard for it. Says our economic and strategic future depends on it. And backers have by no means given up. This hour On Point, the TPP and the country's choice. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Where do you stand on the TPP, on free trade, and what the U.S. needs now? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Is there plenty of criticism of the TPP out there? Here was Hillary Clinton. In her speech at the Democratic National Convention, in this part, she didn't name it, but she was talking about trade and protecting American workers.
If you believe that we should say no to unfair trade deals, that we should stand up to China, that we should support our steel workers and auto workers and homegrown manufacturers, then join us.
Join us. And the crowd roaring there at a rally in Ohio in late June, Donald Trump put a blunter point on it, talking about globalization and trade deals like the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership is another disaster done and pushed by special interests who want to rape our country, just a continuing rape of our country. That's what it is, too. It's a harsh word. It's a rape of our country.
How many times can you say rape in one comment on a trade deal? But here's President Obama at a press conference on Tuesday at the White House. A reporter in the audience asked how he planned to get Congress to pass the TPP, given opposition to it from Hillary Clinton, Tim Kaine, Donald Trump. Here's Obama's response.
Well, right now I'm president, and I'm for it. And I think I've got the better argument. And I've made this argument before. I'll make it again. We are part of a global economy. We're not reversing that. It can't be reversed.
We're part of a global economy, and it cannot be reversed. On the campaign trail, it sounds different. Joining us right now from Englewood, New Jersey, via Skype, is Ben White, chief economic correspondent and Morning Money columnist for Politico, contributor to CNBC. Ben, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Is the TPP dead?
I don't think it's dead. I think it's on serious life support. You know, there used to be a thought among pro-trade politicians that, you know, while it can't get passed during the election year, in the lame duck session in December after the election is over, that supporters of free trade, including Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, the leaders in the House and the Senate, would bring TPP up for a vote. It would pass and Obama would sign it and then the next president wouldn't have to deal with it. That's much less the case now. Both McConnell and Ryan have indicated no enthusiasm for bringing up the deal in the lame duck session. Hillary Clinton, as your piece pointed out, is now opposed to it. I'd say the odds of it coming up in the lame duck are relatively low. It's not impossible, but it's very unlikely. So it's not dead, but it's close to dead.
If it doesn't pass in a lame duck session, and it's, let's do some scenarios here. Let's sure. say it's President Trump. Who has called it a rape of the country. Has he said what he's proposing as an alternative? Would he try and remake it? Would he just renounce it, just shove it away? What would he do?
Well, you're asking whether Trump has come up with specific alternatives, and the answer to that is no, but I don't think you bring up a trade deal you've called repeatedly a rape of the country. So I think TPP under a President Trump would not happen. It would never be introduced. He would never sign it. In terms of alternative trade deals, he has said throughout the campaign that he's a free trader. He likes free trade, but he would renegotiate all our existing trade deals. What he hasn't said is specifically how he would make make them different, either NAFTA or TPP or any of the other either proposed or enacted trade deals. So I think it's safe to say that a President Trump would not have a free trading agenda, would not be interested in new trade deals. Whether he could renegotiate existing ones, I think the answer to that is also no. That would be a very difficult thing to do. But in terms of what his trade agenda would be, I don't think there would really be one. I think he'd focus on infrastructure spending, tax cuts, domestic priorities, and just leave the trade agenda aside.
Ben, remind us just what a big deal the TPP is. You've got a dozen countries in here from all over Asia, not China, not South Korea, not but all around the Pacific Rim.
Yep.
And as I understand, it's all negotiated. That's all done.
Yes.
It's waiting now for ratification in the U.S. case by that would be approval by the U.S. Congress. Remind us just how big a deal it is.
Well, I mean, it's a massive deal. You are talking about 12 countries, including U.S., Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Mexico, Chile, Peru, Vietnam. I mean, that's the list. And then that makes up about 800 million people in population. That's double the size of the EU single market.
40% of the world economy.
40% of world trade, right. Yep. It's enormous. And it would create, if signed, a trading bloc, a unified trading bloc that's double the size of the EU. So we're talking about a massive agreement that would get rid of some 18,000 tariffs. So, you know, you can have the argument about whether this is good for U.S. workers or bad for U.S. workers, and I'm sure we'll get to that in this hour with people smarter than me on those topics. But there's no denying that this is a big thing, and that's why it's such a agenda priority for President Obama and why he's continuing to fight for it, because he wants part of his legacy, this creation of an Asia-Pacific Rim trading bloc that would, you know, rival the EU and that would set the rules for trade and not leave that to China to set the rules. And I think one important point to make here is there are a lot of economists out there who don't want this whole argument on their laps. They think this is more a foreign policy area, that this is something that is in the national interest as a foreign policy matter, particularly vis-a-vis China, and don't want to get that deep into the weeds on the economics because they think ultimately a lot of these trade deals net out to, you know, maybe a slight gain for the U.S. in terms of GDP growth and job growth. And even the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has said it's not going to be a massive game changer on that front over a 10-year time horizon. But in terms of the foreign policy implications, not doing it could be large.
What does that mean? I mean, the argument against it is that it costs Americans jobs, but you're saying it's maybe, and I've seen reports that it may be kind of a wash on that front.
Right.
But when you say foreign policy, is this really about bringing a U.S. version of the world to the 21st century rather than a Chinese version?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think it, at least from the proponent's perspective, it is bringing labor policy, the ability to form unions, collective bargaining, create prohibitions against child labor and forced labor and employment discrimination, and then also on the environmental front, establishing these rules and then sort of promoting economic growth and fair economic growth in a lot of these other countries and the U.S. That would be beneficial to us, and not letting China set these rules that wouldn't include a lot of these provisions. Basically, from a foreign policy standpoint, it's saying we want an American version of trade and labor laws, environmental laws, not what might be the Chinese version of it. And with NAFTA, it was the same thing, that part of the benefit from NAFTA, at least for proponents, is that it promoted economic growth and some more stability in Mexico. And, you know, you get into the counterfactual case here where what would have happened without NAFTA? Would we have had more illegal immigration from Mexico, less stability? So, you know, it's not just a pure what's the X number of U.S. jobs created or GDP growth, but it does the global trade environment look more like a U.S. version or more like somebody else's version?
President Obama went hard at this point in the White House this week as he stood next to the Prime Minister of Singapore visiting on a state visit there. Here's Obama.
If we don't establish strong rules, norms for how trade and commerce are conducted in the Asia-Pacific region, then China will. I mean, China's already engaging all the countries in the region around its own version of trade agreements. And they're sure not worried about labor standards or environmental standards or human trafficking or anti-corruption measures.
Ben White at Politico, how do the votes look? If there were a vote today or in a lame duck session, is it clear how Congress would vote at this point?
No, it's not at all clear. I mean, I think the votes are probably there in the House. They're certainly there in the Senate, and it would just need a simple majority. I think the votes would probably be there in the House. You have a lot of Republicans who are still pro-free trade, even though the top of their ticket is moving in the other direction. And you've got, you know, Democrats who would go along with the president on this. The real political question is, will Republican leadership allow it to come up for a vote? That's really all that matters now. Well, it's not all that matters, but the main thing that matters is, do Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan decide they want to give Obama a vote on TPP in the lame duck? Right now, when I talk to Republican aides, and I talk to a lot of them in Cleveland at the convention, I went in there thinking TPP had a shot in the lame duck. Yeah. I came out thinking it doesn't, because they were very, very clear that they don't think it's going to get a vote.
You know, it got this fast track status. So all it needs is a majority vote. This isn't one of those Senate things. So just 51 votes and it's through the Senate. What has changed for them? The GOP was free trade kind of, you know, forever. And are they that spooked by Donald Trump and his message? This is a rape of the country. Do they feel like their own base has turned that diametrically opposed to this kind of trade deal?
They do think that. And I think what you're seeing here is the great schism in the Republican Party between sort of traditional, more Chamber of Commerce, business-friendly establishment wing of the Republican Party that's been aligned with free trade economists who are ideologically in favor of removing trade barriers. They are losing sway to populist Republicans, you know, embodied by Donald Trump, who see anger at trade deals in Rust Belt states, in Ohio, in Pennsylvania, and Michigan, and blue-collar voters who just don't trust the idea that global trade is good for them, either in the short or the long term. And that's the ascendant part of the party right now, certainly dominated in the Republican primaries. And that's having a lot of influence on even people like McConnell and Ryan, who are traditionally more aligned with establishment Republicans who like free trade. And they're afraid of that wing, and probably rightfully so, because it's very powerful right now.
What if Trump loses on November 8th? Do they turn around and run it through the lame duck session anyway?
It depends how badly he loses. If he gets completely crushed and it looks like that populist movement is not so powerful anymore, there's a chance that they bring it up. But, you know, they also don't want to hand an easy out to Hillary Clinton on this, because I think a lot of Democrats think Hillary really wants it to pass, wants it to go through the lame duck so she doesn't have to deal with it. So it'd be kind of a gift to her. And Republicans are not great gift givers to Hillary Clinton.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the future, the fate of the TPP, the big Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal that's been at the center of so much attack and debate on the campaign trail. Here's sound of people protesting the TPP on the floor of the Democratic National Convention just last week. You can hear in there, no TPP, and it is loud. This week, the president at the White House saying, hey, the TPP gives the U.S. leverage to promote things that many people in this country say they care about.
If you care about preventing abuse of workers, child labor, wildlife trafficking, overfishing, you know, the decimation of forests, all those things are addressed in this agreement.
And at his side in that White House press conference, the Prime Minister of Singapore saying a lot depends on this, the future, the next 50 years and more.
If over the next 50 years you continue to work towards interdependence and cooperation and mutual prosperity, then 50 years from now we can say these have been peaceful years and we have made further progress together. But if you go in the opposite direction, and you decide that this is a big Pacific, but it's big enough to split it down the middle, and one chunk is mine and the other chunk belongs to some of the Asians, China or India or Japan, I think that's a very different world.
Singapore's Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong in the White House this week, standing next to President Obama. What about the TPP? Where do you stand on it? You can join us this hour. Do you want it? Do we need it? Are you against it? Fed up? Not buying the free trade line anymore? On the TPP, anyway. Ben White is with us, Politico's chief economic correspondent. Also, Ben, stand by there in New Jersey. We're also joined right now from Washington by Rob Scott, senior economist and director of trade and manufacturing policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. Rob Scott, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
And with me in the studio here in Boston, Jeffrey Frankel, economist, professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School, director of the Program in International Finance, Microeconomics at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Jeffrey Frankel, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Rob Scott, I think you make an argument against the TPP. You hear the President of the United States, the Prime Minister of Singapore saying there are huge issues here and we've got to have it. Why are you or are you against it?
I am against it, and I think that it represents a step in the wrong direction. These trade deals, I think, are going to lead to growing downward pressure on jobs and wages for most working people in the United States, and it will hurt jobs in other countries in the region as well. It's really going to redistribute wealth from working people throughout the dozen countries in the TPP to large multinational companies, and that's what these deals do. They have shifted the balance of power in favor of big multinationals, and we see that throughout the text of this agreement, which runs some, I think, over 2,000 pages and 30 chapters. Most of it's about special rules created to protect intellectual property rights and the rights of investors of all kinds in ways that are quite pernicious. They really undermine our own legal system.
You know, for so many years, Rob Scott, we have been told that it's a fundamental tenet of economics that free trade makes economies more efficient. You know, they're more competitive. There's more innovation. That it is just sort of carved in stone that this is a net-net gain. Was all that really wrong for so long?
Well, I think trade is good in theory, but we have two problems with that model in practice. As I said, these deals are not about trade. At the moment, we have very low tariffs amongst the countries of the TPP.
Well, I mean, so they're still going to knock out 18,000 tariffs, so there's something about trade here.
Yeah, they're trivial. They're really quite low, and there's not that many involved relative to the overall volume of trade. The average tariffs are a few percent at most. This is not going to have a big impact on trade, and that's what the U.S. International Trade Commission showed in its study of the agreement. The proposed the estimate of benefits is infinitesimally small. It's a few, I think it's about $50 billion, which is equal to the net growth of the economy for about 6 weeks.
President Obama says there's a lot more than tariffs here. Abuse of workers and child labor and wildlife trafficking, overfishing, decimation of forests, all those addressed right in the agreement, he says.
And the problem is those provisions are very difficult to enforce. The labor and environmental provisions, it's just not clear at all how they're going to work. They haven't worked in the NAFTA agreement, and it's not clear that they will work here. What the agreement does do is transfer special rights to foreign investors that will allow them to sue the government if they think their right to earn a profit has been infringed in any way by government regulations of health, safety, or environment. For example, if we put in restrictions on fracking, some multinational from Japan or Canada could sue the U.S. government and claim that its right to earn a profit by engaging in fracking had been threatened, and this could cost us billions of dollars. And this is an extrajudicial proceeding. It's not appealable to the courts anywhere. These are cases that are heard by international tribunals of lawyers hired by the international agencies.
Jeff Frankel, step back with us here and look at this. The temperature on free trade has changed so dramatically during the candidacies of Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Even Hillary Clinton has turned around on this thing. Take us back to basics. How do you look at the TPP? Is this a good idea that's executed poorly? What's going on? Or is it just right?
Well, I do support the TPP. I think the starting point is the standard economic case for trade. And as you say, there are 18,000 tariffs being cut. Two important points. They're not all small. Vietnam, for example, has substantial tariffs, and they do prevent American access to their markets and some of the other countries as well. And the overwhelming majority of these 18,000 tariffs are other countries putting up barriers to our products. We are the ones that have very low barriers, and we didn't agree to remove many of the ones we have left. So even on just straight old-fashioned trade grounds, I think we're going to benefit from more exports. And the other – so that will create export jobs. It will also lower the cost of living for all of us. And admittedly, there will be some losers in addition to the gainers, as is true with any major economic change, people in import-competing industries. But you know, Rob and the other critics and the supporters are all have a point that this is different from past trade agreements. It goes into areas that past trade agreements haven't. It establishes enforceable rules among the members in areas that are traditionally considered the exclusive province of each country's own sovereignty.
Around labor unions and environmental issues.
Well, those are the two that are of most interest to people on the left, if I can characterize it that way, labor and the environment. And then the areas that are of most interest to people on the right are intellectual property rights and the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism that Rob mentioned. But the really major point that I think needs emphasizing is that it could have gone been a giveaway to corporate interests, and that's what the critics feared. But I think they haven't taken a careful enough look at the result, what actually came out last November. So your first guest, Ben White, mentioned that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, was one of the most enthusiastic supporters of fast-track authority and a year ago, is now sort of lost of enthusiasm. And Ben gave the political reasons. But there's a point that's underemphasized. There's also an economic reason. Mitch McConnell comes from the state of Kentucky. Kentucky is a tobacco state. The tobacco companies were hoping to get out of this, out of the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism, protection against countries like Australia with their smoking suppression programs. Australia wants to ban corporate logos on cigarette packs.
Right.
What came out is they can do that. Tobacco didn't get what it wanted. And people, the critics, have not adequately appreciated the extent to which the corporations did not get what they wanted.
So net gain here for the U.S. when you see that there's are losers and gainers. Let's start at the level of nations. Donald Trump says it's a rape of the country.
It's hard to know how to react to anything Donald Trump says, because it says something the opposite the next day, if you'll pardon me for saying so. It is clear gain of the country, for the country.
The United States of America.
For the United States of America, and more for us than for any other country probably, because the other ones are the ones that are reducing their barriers, and we're the ones that are getting our rules for labor and the environment to some extent, to a greater extent than would happen otherwise, adopted in among the 12 major countries.
Ben White, if the USA is a net winner here, how do you interpret the ferocity of the opposition we're seeing in this heavy political season?
Right. Well, I see TPP as a proxy for other issues at play in the U.S. election. And I think, you know, you can't both argue that this is going to be a modestly net positive over the long term for the U.S. and cite those figures and at the same time say somehow is a disaster for U.S. workers and will place all this downward pressure on jobs and wages. I don't think there's a lot of evidence for that. And on the ISDS front, that's in 51 agreements that we've previously agreed to. The U.S. has never lost a case. It's generally in place so that our laws and regulations are not completely violated by other countries. But on the topic of TPP in general, I think this massive movement against it is not based on a lot of people who have read this massively long document. It is frustration with stagnant wages in the U.S. It's frustration with Washington not working and people thinking that corporate interests have too much influence and that money in politics is too big a problem. So I think, you know, you need a symbol to protest against. It's hard to rally around an abstract idea, but if you can tie all these things to TPP and somehow suggest that trade deals alone are the reason that we have not seen middle-class incomes rise and that people feel frustrated, that's why TPP draws all this fire. It's not because of what's specifically in it, I don't think, largely, although, you know, there are certain people who have issues with specific provisions, but I think it's a symbol of much bigger issues at play in American politics.
I want to test that, dig into that. Ben White, please stand by. Jeffrey Frankel, Rob Scott, let's go to our callers as well. Ivan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Ivan, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Hi.
Hi.
And hi, Jeff. I happen to know Jeff, so I'll just jump right in with my point, which I don't think is made enough in this discussion, and it fits right in with what we just finished discussing.
Yes, please.
Which was the status of TPP as a category of free trade deals and the rage against it. And I would just add the simple point, maybe even make it just a question to your panelists. Look, it seems to me that the rage is somewhat misdirected. Jeff is right that there is a powerful economic baseline argument for free trade making sort of all boats rise. You know, so the post-war consensus was not just economic, that all boats will rise, that we all benefit from free trade in our society. But there's a political element, too, which was that free trade is essentially insulation against communism or against totalitarianism, because, you know, we saw the rage that was generated in Germany in the 1920s by rampant inflation, by insecurity, and so on, which palpably led, the political lesson goes, the political story that we have, palpably led to the rise of people like Adolf Hitler. So my point now is, very briefly, is that it's not the free trade deals themselves, it's the choices we make domestically about how the gains from free trade are distributed. And this is a theme, I think, which, again, your panelists could engage, starting with the Reagan administration, but accelerating dramatically to the George W. Bush administration. We see that the gains from free trade are effectively going to a smaller and smaller portion of American society, leading to middle class severe anxiety, working class problems, you know, all kinds of anxiety about the future. And that rage is real, but it's misdirected against free trade when it should be directed against the programs that essentially sort of wipe out a sharing of the gains from free trade. And I'll just say one more thing. Hillary Clinton did stumble. She tried to make exactly this kind of argument. I don't know if you remember her coal miner argument, but she said it was just a rhetorical stumble. She said, and we're going to put coal out of business. She paused for a little bit too long before she said, but we're not going to forget you. We're going to take our resources as a country. We can be nimble. We can be innovative. We can take the people that are losing their jobs as a result of shifts in comparative advantage that happen from free trade. We can take those people and we can help them find vibrant, wonderful, satisfying, happy kinds of careers and alternatives. But of course, she didn't get to make that kind of point because, again, once she says we're putting coal out of business, everybody jumped all over that. But I think that's in the air, and that needs to be talked about more. And I'll just get off the air. Right,
Ivan, now. I appreciate your call. I want to dive in on exactly that. Here was Hillary Clinton. This was in the Democratic debate in Las Vegas. This was in October when she was explaining why she had changed her position on the TPP. We'll come back and look at distribution, but here's Clinton on her change.
It didn't meet my standards for more new good jobs for Americans, for raising wages for Americans. And I want to make sure that I can look into the eyes of any middle-class American and say, this will help raise your wages, and I concluded I could not.
Let's look at that. First, Jeffrey Frankel, this fundamental criticism here that free trade may be great, it may be even a net gain for the United States, but if that net gain is not distributed more widely, you're going to run into political opposition or political upheaval, our caller says. What about that? Has there been a fundamental oversight, or maybe it's not an oversight, design flaw or intentional design that has left the benefits flowing to too few and left a feeling of disenfranchisement in the global economy for many Americans?
Right. Well, Ivan is right. The other guests are right that where this is coming from, this fervent opposition to TPP is linked to widespread anger from workers who feel that they have been left behind by long-term economic trends. Now, I personally think they way overestimate the role of trade in that and underestimate other factors like technology and education. But increase in inequality is very real. It's been going on for 40 years and especially since the turn of the century. And, you know, probably a bit of that at least is due to trade. And here's the point I would like to make. Mm. Whether you think want to assign a lot of responsibility for the increased inequality to trade or little, in a sense, doesn't matter. Globalization, as you quoted the president as saying, is a fact. The quote was, cannot be reversed. It doesn't actually – it's true in past elections and it's true in this elections. Which party gets his president elected actually doesn't make that much difference to trade policy or trade. They all like to say they're going to negotiate better deals. It's easy to say on the campaign trail. And then when you're in the negotiations, you discover the U.S. has already gotten pretty much the best it can, and there are other countries with other interests, and there's limits how far you can go. The choice between the parties is something quite different in my view. Ivan referred to and quoted Hillary in respect to the coal miners compensating the losers. So the theorem of economics is trade increases the total size of the pie. It changes the income distribution. It benefits the winners enough that they can compensate the losers. The critics say, but that doesn't happen. The difference between the two parties, if I can get partisan for a moment, is that the Democrats now and consistently have pushed for measures that would do precisely that. I have in mind universal health insurance, trade adjustment assistance, wage insurance, the earned income tax credit, progressive taxation, infrastructure spending, universal preschool. These are all things that can address the disappearing middle class, the increase in inequality, regardless of whether you think it's due to trade or technology or something else. And they are measures that the Democrats have consistently supported and the Republicans have consistently tried to block and in some cases have succeeded in blocking.
But here we are, hard to be blasé about the whole setup when a whole lot of voters are saying, no, I mean, in both parties now, lining up behind candidates saying no to the biggest trade deal ever. Jeffrey Frankel, please stand by. From Harvard's Kennedy School, Rob Scott at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, Ben White with Politico. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the future, the fate of the TPP, the big Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal that's been at the center of so much attack and debate on the campaign trail this year. Ben White is with us from Politico, chief economic correspondent there. Jeffrey Frankel joins us, economist, professor at Harvard's Kennedy School. Rob Scott is with us, senior economist, director of trade and manufacturing policy research at the Economic Policy Institute. You can join us as well. What do you think? Can we have the TPP and not disenfranchise, not sideline more Americans? And what would pulling out now do to America's standing, its position in Asia, around the Pacific, in the world, the way the world works? Lots of fervor on both sides. You're Donald Trump, very outspoken. We had here Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren talking during the Democratic National Convention last week. She talked with the Labor Council about trade and the TPP.
No more trade deals that help giant international corporations and leave workers in the dirt.
There will be no more, says the one U.S. senator there. Before the whole convention, we had Bernie Sanders. He went off his prepared remarks last week to voice his opposition to the TPP, started by saying he was happy with the Democratic Party's platform stance on trade.
It also calls for strong opposition to job-killing trade agreements like the TPP. Our job, we have got to make sure that TPP does not get to the floor of the Congress in the lame duck session.
Of course, that Democratic platform does not come out with an outright rejection of the TPP. Donald Trump saying if it's Hillary in the White House, she'll push it through.
The day she gets in, which hopefully will never happen, she will approve, or shortly thereafter, TPP. And that will be another disaster for jobs in our country.
Tim in Columbia, Missouri. Tim, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me on. Mm-hmm. I work for an organization called the Missouri Rural Crisis Center. We're a family farm organization, represent independent family farmers and livestock producers. And there are two things I want to bring up, and these can be extrapolated, I think, through different industries, not just agriculture, and also within agriculture. And that's one, that it allows multinational packers, i.e. JBS Swift, Cargill, Pilgrim's Pride, who's owned by JBS Swift, to go around the world and buy the cheapest meat, both in boxes and on the hook, live animals, import them into the United States, and undercut U.S. farmers, putting independent family farmers out of business. It has happened. It's happened through NAFTA. It's happened through other free trade agreements. And number two, it usurps or trumps our democratic process. And an example is country of origin labeling. The World Trade Organization ruled that our democratically enacted law, country of origin labeling, which was enacted in the 2008 Farm Bill, was a trade barrier, which is country of origin labeling. It says when packers have to label where the beef comes from, where it's born, slaughtered, and raised.
Yep.
They ruled it was a trade barrier, and Congress reacted and said we have to get rid of it because the World Trade Organization said it was a trade barrier, even though 90% of Americans want to know where their meat comes from. So it's bad for independent family farmers, and it's bad for consumers.
So, Tim, your argument is that for American family farmers to thrive or survive— Americans should not have necessarily access to the least expensive meat products from around the world.
I think, no, my argument is that farmers should be paid a price based upon what consumers are paying. It allows meat packers to create, to make a bigger margin. Uh-huh. It's vertically integrated and a monopolized industry, and they can buy it as cheap as they want anywhere in the world and undercut U.S. farmers, putting U.S. farmers out of business and then killing jobs. That not only kills the independent family farmer, but it also kills the infrastructure of rural communities that are based upon independent livestock production.
Tim, we've got it from Columbia, Missouri. Jeffrey Frankel, I see you shaking your head. No, but let me get Rob Scott on this first. Rob, is there something structural in these global trade deals that necessarily advantages larger corporate entities? Does embracing globalization have to mean, big corporations having bigger profit margins, more power, and more centralized power overall?
Well, the fact of the matter is that's how it has worked. These trade deals are negotiated. The TPP was negotiated in a process where the U.S. set up advisory committees with representatives from about 500 representatives from large multinational companies. They wrote down the text that they want. They handed it to the negotiators, and the negotiators put it in the agreement. That's literally how the process works. There were about, I think, at most a dozen representatives of labor and consumer groups on those advisory committees. So this process worked to the benefit of large multinational companies. And the WTO does the same thing. So I think the caller raises some very important points. This country of origin labeling ruling from the WTO made it very difficult for consumers to find out where their food is coming from. We have almost no inspectors for food quality at the border for food that's coming in via imports that this agreement will require us to take. Very, very few inspections. Consumers have no way of knowing where their products that they're buying are coming from. So I think it does present serious concerns, not just for workers and for farmers, but also for consumers and their families.
How about it, Jeffrey Frankel? Is there a problem? I mean, you can look at the farm case, but then take it bigger. You criticize Republicans for not approving, not getting on board with countervailing measures that would help people who are disadvantaged by globalization. But Democrats were in, too, on how these agreements were written. Have they been written in such a way that it structurally advantages large corporate interests at the expense of a more diverse field of players?
Well, I'd like to comment on the last caller, who I think it was not at all representative of farmers. Most farmers are in favor of trade agreements, past and future, and the reason is they benefit from them. Specifically, in the case of TPP, we'll have dairy exports to Canada, poultry exports to Vietnam, exports of beef and pork and soy and wine to Japan, because these countries currently have barriers. The thing about meat inspections, we get worried about if the quality of meat and the standards is equal in Latin America to ours, and we often have differences that some people look like protectionism and other people look like quality. Guess what? Japan feels exactly the same way about our meat. Mm-hmm. They say our standards aren't good enough. What TPP would do is apply uniform standards, our standards, throughout this huge
region. How do you know if those are being met if they're not inspected at the border or somewhere?
It is moving in the direction we want to move, which is having U.S. rules throughout this region, Asia-Pacific region, and it backs it up with these mechanisms where you can bring complaints and you can have trade barriers. And that applies across the board. It applies to these issues like the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism and intellectual property rights, as well as to the environment and labor. I hope at some point we'll have a chance to talk about all the great things that are in it for the environment in Chapter 20, which for the very first time back up environmental agreements like prohibiting trade in endangered species, which we've got under CITES. Yep. It actually backs it up with
Elephant tusks and all the rest. You can
exactly the rhinoceros and the
and on and on
exotic reptiles and birds and all that. We have international agreement, which is called CITES. Each country is just sort of supposed to try to enforce it, but it's often not enforced. For the very first time under TPP, countries are obligated at the national level to enforce it. And if they don't, they can be the subject of complaints and trade sanctions, which is exactly what the environmentalists have been asking for years. Why can't we have in our multilateral environmental agreements serious trade penalties backing it up the way the trade agreements do? It's exactly what they've been asking for. And here for the first time, they've got it. And I don't think that they've, many cases, environmental NGOs have read the environmental chapter. It's endangered species. It's overfishing of oceans, subsidizing ocean fleets that depletes fish stocks. It's dumping of waste products and fuel by ocean-going ships. Mm-hmm. For the very first time, we're addressing these at a multilateral level. And it's backed up by serious measures.
These are big deals on point after point if they can be backed up and enforced. But go to the big structural thing. And the caller suggests this in a way from small farmers worried about this. Bernie Sanders comes right out and says it's a threat to our democracy because the globalization represented here leads to a concentration of power. Corporate and maybe beyond. What about that argument, Jeffrey Frankel?
Well, perhaps the most common critique of all of them that I've heard over the last year is that it's not been a democratic process because during the negotiation, they didn't release the text and they didn't sufficiently involve the Senate, the Congress in the process. Now, one answer to that is, well, now you have the text. Now, take a look at that, please. But here's another thing which the critics seem to miss. I mentioned that Mitch McConnell now has his doubts because the tobacco industry didn't get what it wants. Mm-hmm. The pharmaceutical industry didn't get what it wanted, at least not the whole thing. And for that reason, Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah has lost enthusiasm for it. If the Congress had been fully involved in the negotiations at every step of the way, remember, both the House and the Senate are controlled by Republicans. McConnell and Hatch would have gotten what they wanted for the pharmaceutical and tobacco industries and other big corporate interests to a much greater extent if they had been involved all along. So this criticism that it's not sufficiently democratic, and if it were democratic and open process, I, the critic, would have gotten everything I wanted, it seems to me fantasy.
Jennifer in Rutland, Vermont. Jennifer, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling because as an attorney, the provision in the TPP that profoundly concerns me is the creation of a right to earn a profit. American law does not recognize a right to earn a profit. And what the TPP will allow, which is not a free trade, it is a corporate favorable means of subverting our democratic process, is for example, an American corporation to reincorporate abroad and then sue outside of our legal courts to subvert democratically passed regulations of business. So let's say we pass regulations. One of the prior callers said we could regulate fracking because of environmental concerns. So ExxonMobil can reincorporate elsewhere and then sue the government, demanding that under its right to earn a profit by fracking, it must subvert the democratically passed legislation on fracking.
Jennifer, let us pick it up right there, because I think we've all heard about this, and it does get people wondering. Ben White, what about it? I mean, we saw this. Isn't TransCanada right now seeking something like $15 billion in damages over the Obama administration's decision to cancel the Keystone Pipeline or not go with it? And they're suing, I think, through this arbitration process established by NAFTA, saying that the U.S. violated its obligations under NAFTA. Do we get into a supranational sort of court cases where the U.S. can't, doesn't have control over the fate of its own even laws or decisions?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't think that we do. And just because they're suing for this doesn't mean they're going to get it. And as I stated before, we've never lost a case in ISDS. The settlement dispute process. Elizabeth Warren will say, well, we haven't lost yet. Maybe we will in the future. And I think that Rob made the point that these are not reviewable. And Jeff could speak to this better than I could. But I believe that they are now reviewable, and that they've made some significant changes to the ISDS process. But, from a political perspective, it is certainly a concern that critics have raised that we will lose sovereignty and that corporations will be able to sue in these unaccountable arbitration panels to gut U.S. Environmental regulations and laws. There's just no precedent for that happening, and I think it may be a red herring and a misnomer to think that it's actually going to unleash this tide of corporate interests gutting U.S. laws. because I just don't think there's precedent for it or any reason to think it's actually going to happen. But I'd let Jeff speak to the changes in ISDS.
Tom, I'd like to jump in on this.
Yeah.
I think we have 2 points. First of all, I think we have to recognize what the caller says, which is that this embodiment of this, this notion of the takings of a right to earn profit is a radical right-wing agenda item. It doesn't come out of our legal code. It's something that's created in these international agreements. And I think it creates a distortion in the balance of power that works heavily in the favor of multinational corporations. Tom, I think, is wishful or hopeful that it so far we haven't been hurt, so it's going to be okay. Well, frankly, this has shifted the balance of power, and I think that it does impose a great threat to our ability to regulate the economy. And secondly, it does take the process of regulation out of the domestic courts or international courts and puts it in the hands of these private international tribunals, and that's a fundamental shift of power as well. So I think both of those are very good reasons to be concerned about these deals.
Jeffrey Frankel, your thought on that front?
It's just amazing how many myths there are out there. It's hard to think of issues where so many people have a view of what's in it that just isn't in it. You hear all the time the criticism that that there's a provision that corporations have a right to earn a profit. It just isn't there. It's not true. To my mind, it's almost like people saying Obama was born outside the United States. Go take a look at it. But it has a life of its own. And I mentioned the example of Australian cigarette mm-hmm. Packs. There's no question that U.S. tobacco companies are going to make less profits selling cigarettes in Australia because they're banned from putting logos there. And it is crystal clear, the way the agreement came out, that they don't have the right to do that.
Sue over that. Mm-hmm.
As Ben said, anybody could sue over anything, but it would be tossed out instantly. And he's right. There have been a number of reforms in the investor-state dispute settlement mechanism relative to earlier ones, like the agreement with Korea and NAFTA and all that. One of them, for example, it was a valid charge that it costs money to sue, and U.S. multinationals have big law firms and some small country maybe doesn't. One of the many reforms is that there's provision for dismissing frivolous suits.
Ben White, I was moved by the Singaporean Prime Minister's plea. He said, look, without this, we put a lot of work into this. You're going to cut us adrift. You're going to cut the Pacific in half. It's going to be a divided world, China kind of versus the U.S., and we're not sure American ways are going to win here. What about that argument in Washington these days, Ben?
Well, I don't think it holds sway, unfortunately. I think it's probably the right argument, but the deal has not been sold that way, unfortunately, and trade deals haven't been sold that way over the years. They've been oversold on the benefits to the U.S. economy and undersold on their importance to setting up a global trade network that reflects American values, American laws, a lot of stuff that would be in the TPP that would be beneficial to us. But, the conversation's just going to have to change around how these deals are described and sold.
We'll be back to it later in the year. Ben Whitewater, Time Right There with Politico, Jeffrey Frankel from Harvard, Rob Scott with the Economic Policy Institute. Our thanks to all of you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.